Welcome back to the Battle of Stalingrad podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 28, and Manstein's attempted break into Stalingrad has ground to a halt. He needs Paulus to push back from the inside, and the 6th Army commander is like a bunny in the headlights, waiting for Adolf Hitler to give him permission. But the Führer has long decided that it's death or glory in Stalingrad, no retreat, despite the 6th Army being surrounded by the Russians after the Operation Uranus success. We concentrated last week on the push to try and dent the iron ring around Paulus and the 249,000 Germans trapped in the Kessel. The other battle, as historian and secret agent Ronald Seth noted, was the condition of the Germans in the city. They were more fortunate than their comrades in the steppes. At least they had the shelter of broken buildings and the luxury of snugger basements to protect them against the minus 35 degrees centigrade Arctic winds, the plate glass ice, and the thick, silent snow. This was their only advantage, however, except for the rats feeding on corpses. The German comforts were 2.5 ounces of bread and a pint of muddy water, which was described as soup, a slither of horse meat if they were lucky. The rats were hunted for their own coarse, rancid flesh, despite the fact they'd obviously been gorging on dead Germans and Russians. A sick cycle of life based on the dead. How they hung on even now at Christmas 1942, none could say later. One thing had changed by Christmas. The Russians had slackened off on their pressure inside the city, but only slightly, and only for a moment. The Red Army, sometimes based in the same house, had thick woolen underwear, fleecy lined felt boots, skin caps with earmuffs, sheepskin lined coats, and white camouflage capes with hoods. They emerged with the snow and ate their 2 hot meals a day wherever they were, enough food to keep them warm and quiet and comfortable. They also had their shots of vodka every day to help dissolve depression and chase away the cold. As a military operations paramedic instructor, I know that alcohol given to folks who are suffering from exposure is tantamount to shooting them in the head, but it's a great additive if you are already warm. The Soviet High Command had only reinforced General Chirkov's 62nd Army in the city in sufficient numbers to prevent the Germans from taking Stalingrad Center. The 6th Army had been driven back so many times from the shores of the Volga by the Russians, it was so superhuman, it was supernatural. And by now, it was known by the Soviet top brass that Hitler had developed a Stalingrad complex, and that even if his armies on the steppe were all destroyed, he'd still demand that General Paulus and his troops fight on until the last man dropped dead. That greatly assisted Yeremenko and Zhukov in their strategy, and once the vast mass of the 6th Army was surrounded, both turned their attentions back towards the city once more. And it was across the Volga on the 21st of December that Futak Formanov was standing near the river, and he was not a happy man. Formanov was from Azerbaijan, a child of the sun and burning sands. He loved August and September in Stalingrad. It reminded him of home. Now in December, when the mercury in the glass dropped so low that he had to tap it to make sure there was something left, he was unhappy. A few days before Christmas, he was sent by his battalion commander across the river to fetch a box of percussion caps for mines. It was early evening, and he intended to make his way back overnight, but he was slowed by the army processes. Hurry up and wait, as they say in the military. As he sat waiting for his turn to cross the frozen river back to the western bank, he noticed a few men standing behind some bushes. They were also waiting to cross, and as the morning light brightened, he heard their laughter. Then they started rolling around in the snow, pelting each other with snowballs. Oh well, perhaps a little hijinks. Maybe it was their amazing uniforms, white all over, except some seemed to have dark patches on their chests. Then they ran towards him, and in a moment of shock he realized they were stark naked. Formanov almost keeled over from shock, writes Ronald Seth, and buried his head in his chest, thinking they had been pushed over the edge, they had gone mad, and now they were heading his way. Moments later he realized who they were. He had heard about these crazy men from the north, and the Siberians, who had been sent to stiffen the veterans on the Volga. They were informal members of what is now known as the Polar Bear Club. Over 1,000 miles to the northwest at the Wolf's Lair in East Prussia, a tragic war of nerves was being played out. German Chief of Staff General Kurt Zeitzler had dropped his pretense of sycophant as he desperately sought Hitler's permission for Operation Thunderclap. Remember, That was Manstein's two-pronged plan, where he'd drive towards Paulus, who'd reciprocate by ordering the 6th Army to mobilize towards Hoth's panzers south of Stalingrad. They had a chance to punch their way towards each other. Zeitzler told Hitler that everyone in the officers' mess at the Wolf's Lair should reduce their rations as both a tribute to the men of the Kessel and a reminder it was OKW's responsibility to bring everyone out alive. The annoyed dictator merely waved him aside, and Zeitzler strode back to his office in a towering rage. But he was being opposed inside the Kessel by Hitler's Nazi eyes and ears, Paulus's chief of staff, General Arthur Schmidt. On the 21st of December, Schmidt had sent Hitler the latest ammunition and fuel supplies report. They had only 140 cubic meters of fuel that would last 20 miles, as I said last podcast, and even if the Führer had entertained thoughts of a breakout, Schmidt swept these away. The next day, Manstein sent Hitler another top-secret message, identified as Document Army Group Don number 39694/5. The development of the situation on the left flank, Italian sector of the army group makes it necessary to move up forces there very soon, he telexed. In order to maintain the physical strength of the army through adequate nutrition and to enable the army to engage in defensive operations, an average daily supply of at least 550 tons is required. Of course, by now, less than 100 tons were coming in per week and the weather had closed in. But it was another telex on the 22nd December at 5:10 in the afternoon from General Schultz at Novocherkassk to General Schmidt inside the Stalingrad Kessel that underlined the fact that the time for deliverance had vanished. The situation at the all-important thrust on the Mishkovo River south of the surrounded 6th Army had changed for the worse. Hoth's 6th and 17th Armored Divisions at Vasilevska were engaged all day today in repulsing strong enemy attacks from the southeast, east and north, so that the armored divisions were not able to make the intended thrust towards the north. In short, the break-in attempted by Hoth and Manstein had failed. The last portion of this report featured a rather chilling set of stats. According to the report of the quartermaster, 6th Army, there are still about 40,000 horses in the pocket, telexts Schultz. This report is contradicted by Major Eichmann, who reported that the divisions had only about 800 horses left. Schultz wanted to know what the exact number was. What kind of horses were they, ponies or larger, as well as the steps being taken to preserve horse meat? Incredible, isn't it? The powerful army that had thrust its way over 1,000 miles into the southeast of Russia, had crushed millions of Soviet soldiers on its way, was now down to a few strips of horse meat per man per week. The real figure was actually 23,000 horses, and they'd all be eaten by mid-January. Goering's uselessness and arrogance in believing his all-conquering Luftwaffe could provide up to 500 tons a day, or even the 350 tons he guaranteed, had lulled all into a false sense of their own survivability. Here are some other stats worth noting. Total number of men inside the pocket and Stalingrad was actually 249,000, including 13,000 Romanians, 19,300 auxiliary volunteers, or what were known as the Russian Huey laborers, and around 6,000 wounded. The actual battle strength was tiny. Infantry, 25,000. Engineers, 3,200. Ammunition stocks were running out. There were only 3,000 rounds for field howitzers, 900 for the heavy howitzers, and 600 for all other guns. Men had been on half rations since mid-November and were unable to march properly or even engage in offensive actions. They had begun to die of starvation. Still, Hoth didn't give up. At 6:30 a.m. on the 23rd December, his 6th Panzer Division renewed its offensive in an attempt at widening the bridgehead at Vasilevska on the Mishkovo River, south of the Kessel. At 12:30 p.m. that day, the 57th Corps Commander, General Kirshner, arrived in the area to gather intel on what was going wrong. At 1 p.m., a teleprinter clicked into gear at Manstein's HQ. It was from Hitler, and Manstein was sure it was now permission to start Operation Thunderclap. Paulus was going to move south, surely. Personal and immediate, went the telex preamble. Following from the Führer begins. The railway junction at Morozovskaya and the two air bases at Morozovsk and Tatsinskaya will be held and kept in operation at all costs. Hitler was ignoring Thunderclap. but he was warning about the airfield at Tsatsinskaya, and as we'll see shortly, that was pertinent for what was about to happen. And thus, Manstein issued the fateful order to the 6th Panzer Division at the Mishkovo River. The division will be taken out of the bridgehead tonight. Trail guards will be left behind. Staff officers miles away on the Mishkovo River stared at the slip of paper they'd been handed but knew it was the logical conclusion. They could not defeat the Russian 2nd Guards Army and other formations. They had been defeated. It was impossible to break through without their brothers shut up inside the Kessel, fighting their way out. For the Italians of the 8th Army, the last 5 days had been beyond excruciating. It was 150 miles northwest of Gumruk, where the steppe lay under 10 feet of snow, that a dark column of Italian prisoners wound through the bleak landscape, shuffling painfully, haltingly. Amongst these was our lieutenant we met last episode, Felice Bracci. He was walking in the middle of this line of men from the Kalmykov-Meshkov in the Don River Russian attacks. The Russian guards shouted, "Davai, bistre," or "Hurry up," but the men were frostbitten, their feet were black. As Felice staggered forward, he heard the single rifle and pistol shots at times which echoed in the snowy stillness as Russians executed prisoners who collapsed from exhaustion. They had been marching for 2 days without halting for a rest. It was as though the Russians had embarked these men on a death march, all the way from Kalmykov. Corpses marked their path alongside the road, and as they headed back north towards the Don River, evidence of the harsh fighting littered the roadside. Pieces of uniform, destroyed artillery, arms, legs, the wreckage of the Italian 8th Army peppered the steppe. At dusk, the Russians finally halted the thinning column and Bracci collapsed in a stable. Other remnants of the 8th Army were still retreating and fighting. Near the town of Abruzhovska, 30 miles west of where Bracci slept in his stable, Russian gunners had installed their Katyusha rockets on a ridge overlooking a valley. They whooshed into the writhing grey masses of Italian troops below. Suddenly, a small German detachment trapped at one end of this valley cul-de-sac managed somehow to commandeer a few trucks, and they made a run through the gauntlet. A few Italian soldiers tried to jump on the running boards, but the Germans shot them. Former allies now dishonorably murdering their own side. The Germans escaped, leaving Italian Dr. Cristoforo Caponi alive to tell this tale, but not many officers survived. Rather than be taken by the Russians, they shot themselves, as most of their men were being gunned down by the Soviet troops. It was now on the eve of Christmas and disaster that General Paulus finally decided he must disobey Hitler, but he still didn't have the guts to take the final decision. He telexed Manstein once more and said, "Am I to take it that I am now authorized to initiate Operation Thunderclap? Once it's launched, there will be no turning back. Over." So now, we are at the climax of weeks of back and forth. A single line on a telex machine. Paulus was asking Manstein to order him to break out. Later, Manstein would try to deflect the fact that it was this moment where he could have saved some of the 249,000 men huddled in the Kessel, but appeared more interested in saving his newly installed field marshal status by hedging. "I can't give you authority today," he telexed back. "But I hope to get permission tomorrow." Putting off until tomorrow what must be done today is not how the Germans had conducted their war. A few hours after this exchange, the tanks of the 6th Panzer Division holding the bridgehead at Vasilevskaya wheeled about and began to recross the Mishkovo River. As historian William Craig writes in his fantastic work, Enemy at the Gates, hard-bitten panzer crews brushed tears from their eyes as they turned their backs on their countrymen waiting for them in Stalingrad. They were also turning their backs on any chance of victory in Russia, a symbolic action. One officer stood in his turret hatch facing the northeast horizon, slapped a salute to his cap, then ducked back inside the Mark IV panzer as it rumbled off, heading towards Manstein's left flank, where we know the Italian 8th Army had collapsed. 686 Germans died on that day, as Manstein did it. Paulus prevaricated, and Hitler sat back in the wolf's lair, nibbling his vegan butternut puffs, followed up by a slice of chocolate cake, swilled down with his interminable tea. It was Christmas Eve, dawn on the 24th of December 1942, when the great German airfield at Tsatsinskaya, 180 miles west of Gumruk, came under artillery fire from the Soviet Third Guards Army. Remember, Gumeruk was where Paulus was based inside the Kessel, and this attack so far to the west was unexpected. Generals Martin Fiebig and Freie von Richthofen had implored Hitler for permission to move the transport plane stationed at the airfield out of danger, but Hitler rejected their appeal, saying the German reserves in the area were more than enough a match for the Slavs, whom he despised, as we know. His racist views now came back to haunt the poor pilots of Tatsinskaya on the misty morning of Christmas Eve. Fiebig, who was Hermann Göring's second-in-command, was actually at the airfield that day, and in fact was standing inside the control tower when the first shells exploded around his parked planes. Two Junker 52s blew up alongside the tower, and a colonel beside him begged, "Herr General, you must take action, you must give permission to take off." Incredibly, Fiebig said no, he needed orders from Luftwaffe authority, and besides, the fog was too thick. As a pilot, we all know that you can take off in such weather and find a clear airfield to land, so he was being purely obtuse. The ashen-faced colonel then squared up to Fiebig, standing at rigid attention. "Either you take that risk or every unit on the field will be wiped out. All the transport units for Stalingrad, Herr General, the last hope of the surrounded 6th Army." Finally, Fiebig gave in as Russian shells slammed onto the runways and gave the order. At 5:30 in the morning and 10 minutes after the first salvo of artillery rounds, the Junker 52s roared into life and scrambled. It was confusion and chaos. Planes took off from all directions. Two Junkers collided and blew up, while others had their wings and tails ripped off. And into this chaos, Russian T-34 tanks appeared, with upwards of 50 Junkers taking off just above their hulking hulls. By 6:07, dozens of planes were burning. Russian tanks were rolling past Fiebig as he stared mesmerized in the control tower. Tatsinskaya had been overrun. Fiebig just made it out, and his plane crawled towards Rostov. 56 aircraft had been gutted. Only 124 got away. General Choikov, commander of the Russian 62nd Army, decided that morning to take a trip to the east side of the Volga, descending from his bunker carved out of the riverbank back in Stalingrad. He was more cautious this time. You see, on the 19th December, he'd headed east for a party given by the commander of the NKVD in honor of the founding of this feared department of the Cheka. Choikov, as was his wont, had a few too many shots of vodka, like all present, and very drunk, had fallen through a hole in the ice into the freezing Volga River upon his return journey. Fortunately, he had been fished out. The commander of the 62nd Army was very aware that he'd nearly met an ignominious end. Imagine the stories after all he'd done to defeat the Germans, merely to drown in the Volga like a drunkard. So this time, on Christmas Eve, Vasily Choikov was in festive mood because Colonel Ivan Ludnikov's 138th Division had finally made contact with the rest of the Soviet 62nd. He had held off numerous German attacks by the 305th Division for more than a month, then managed to hold off the much-feared German pioneer battalions, who were expert street fighters. The 138th had finally surged up the bank of the Volga to flat ground behind the factories and turned south, clearing the Germans as they went. It was a beaming group of Russian officers who sat together in Choikov's warm, tunneled-out office bunker on December 24th. There, Choikov smoked his leather-holded cigarettes and raised tumblers of vodka to toast his fellow heroes of the siege. Among them, General Ivan Petrovich Sologub, who joined Choikov in the summer battles on the steppe. General Fyodor Nikandrovich Smekotvorov, who defended the Red October plant almost to the last man. General Viktor Grigorievich Zolotov, whose elite commanders had been wiped out at the tractor factory. These officers were now ordered to take their men out of the battle to the far side of the Volga and to rest camps and recover. They had been shattered. Of 20,000 men they had led into Stalingrad, only 2,000 walked eastwards across the ice-covered river to their rendezvous with R&R. Going the other way were thousands upon thousands of fresh reinforcements. But also marching that day, not far away inside Stalingrad, were angry and bitter German troops bent on revenge. They had eventually realized that a young Russian who'd been fixing their boots was a spy. His name was Sasha Filipov, and he was only 15. His mother ran out with some food as Sasha and two other teenagers were being marched past her house, all three barefoot in the snow. Russian civilians gathered as the Germans looped a noose around Sasha's head and tightened a thick knot under his left ear. Mr. Filipov moaned, broke away from the group, stumbled off, never looking back. The command was given for the execution, and Mrs. Filipov watched as Sasha's tongue shot out from between his teeth and his face turned blue. Then the Germans formed ranks and marched away, leaving the three boys swinging in the icy morning, Christmas Eve, 1942. Bryanskaya Street was suddenly deserted as Mrs. Filipov stroked her son's cold legs, listening to the creaking of the rope. It was still dark on the day before Christmas, and she stood still at his side, her master cobbler, hanged at 15. He had spent 6 months spying on the Germans, providing pinpoint artillery targets for the Soviets, and eventually his luck had run out. Time and luck was also running out for every German inside the Kessel. Oh Tannenbaum, wir trusin deine Blatter, sang troops in bunkers, as that night hundreds of multicolored flares flashed across the sky from Olovka in the northeast to Barbukin in the west, down to Marinovka and Karpovka, back east through to Zybenko, all the way to Tsaritsa Gorge on the Volga. It was the German salute to the holy season, supposedly a joyous time, but in Stalingrad tinged with horror and sadness. Liquor was broken out, dazed lanzas slumped together, singing and crying as they belted out Christmas carols. Every bunker was bedecked with some form of Christmas tree. Gramophones could be heard, while men shared presents they'd preserved for each other. Chocolates, bread, biscuits, coffee, cigarettes, even cigars. Outside, unburied bodies lay stiff and frozen, lining the roads, but there was no way to dig into the rock-hard step. But if the Germans thought Christmas Day was going to be a day of rest, they were sorely mistaken. In the early hours of 25th December, a violent blizzard blew into the Kessel and visibility dropped to 10 yards as 50-mile-an-hour gusts howled through the bulkers and foxholes while the 6th Army slept off wine and rum. At 5 a.m. on Christmas Day, the Russians opened fire with Katyusha rockets, heavy-throated mortars and artillery. Moments after the bombardment ended, the ground heaving and shaking, tank after tank appeared in the grey and between them trucks crowded with infantry. In the sector held by the 16th Panzer Division, groggy soldiers rushed to defend their positions, but the Russians were moving too fast. By the afternoon, the Germans had been forced to blow up most of their 188mm artillery pieces and retreat. They'd run out of ammunition. Piles of dead Russians and Germans could be seen in the snow. The battle continued through the afternoon, and on the 16th Division's flanks, more battles were reported. Eventually, the entire Kessel reverberated with the sounds of big and small caliber weapons on Christmas. 1,280 Germans died on Christmas Day in the pocket of Stalingrad, and that night the men of Stalingrad were treated to Propaganda Minister Joseph Goebbels' so-called ring broadcast, supposedly a live crossing from somewhere on the frontier of the Third Reich. Goebbels chanted the names of conquered cities as German civilians back home lay back in their comfy chairs, visualizing the grandness of the empire. "And now from Narvik," announced Goebbels as a rising swell of singing could be heard behind his voice, supposedly from those based at the Norwegian port. "And now from Tunisia, and now from Stalingrad." Thousands of soldiers heard this and stared at each other in disbelief as singers supposedly standing in the Volga bank sang a verse of "Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht." Most Germans huddled in a blizzard in the Kessel switched off their radios in disgust. The next day, Boxing Day, they were more disgusted. Drastic measures had been instituted by porters from that moment to conserve what little food was left. They had bread for 2 days, other edibles for 1 day, no oils or fats. 249,000 men were starving. Fuel had run out. Paulus had known for some days that rations must be cut, but he waited until Christmas. Then he passed the starvation diet. 2 ounces of bread per soldier per day, that's about the size of a man's thumb. Soup, no fat for lunch. 1 can of meat where available, otherwise water parading as soup for dinner. It was also at that moment that the Russians ruptured the communication umbilical cord between Gumrak and Novocherkassk. The fragile connection left the 6th Army with a single 1,000-watt transmitter and a few auxiliary sets to communicate with Army Group Don. Dark times awaited. So we must end this episode. Next week, we'll hear how Stalin was stewing in Moscow, fuming at the delay and the destruction of the 6th Army, ignoring the constant stream of comms from his front commanders boasting of victory after victory. Still, the Germans fought. How could it be possible, he thought. Thanks to Phil, by the way, who tweeted about the podcast and shared a picture of Russian vets he spoke to on the Mamayev Kurgan during an historical visit in 2002. Hardly any of these men and women are left, so it's very important to get these stories while they're still around. And people like Phil are doing a vital job. Phil, by the way, is identified as a walker of battlefields with a Master of Arts in Military History, who's also researching the British Army in 19th century China. So thanks again, Phil, for supporting my little podcast. By the way, if you'd like to see some maps about Barbarossa, head off to the website abwarpodcast.com. That's abwarpodcast.com, where you'll find the Battle of Stalingrad page. Please rate the podcast on iTunes if you can, or you can contact me on Twitter at Des Latham. Have a restful Christmas season, folks. Until next we meet, goodbye.